Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
Welcome to Wheels Off, a show about the messy reality of the creative life. I'm Rhett Miller.
That's when it got wheels off. We started up and we ain't gonna stop. Oh, I said I like you, like it or not. That's when it got wheels off.
Kathy Valentine is more than just the bassist for the Go-Go's. She did spend the first half of the 1980s conquering the world as the bass player for the Go-Go's. She wrote the song Vacation, for God's sake. But there's a lot more to Kathy Valentine. She has a beautiful new memoir out called All I Ever Wanted. I mentioned during the course of the interview you're about to hear that the audiobook version is superb. I recommend it. And she's done a lot. She did a lot of music before ever being in the Go-Go's. And she's had a lifetime of music since the Go-Go's broke up. Bands like the Blue Bonnets, the Delphines. She's made records as herself, Kathy Valentine. She's done a ton of stuff. She lives now in Austin, Texas. We did have a technical snafu about a week ago, or before I'm recording this introduction right now, before we just recorded our interview moments ago. We recorded an interview, and it was so great. I was a hard-hitting journalist. I drew from her all this incredible wisdom, and I asked all the hard-hitting questions, only to realize after it was over that the platform we were using did not record the interview at all. Kathy was cool enough to be willing to try it again, and the second interview was different, but it was equally great, maybe better in a lot of ways. She's a really generous human being and a really cool person, and I'm so glad I got to speak to Kathy Valentine. Welcome to Wheels Off. Welcome to Wheels Off, Kathy Valentine.
Okay. All right. There was one part. No, I was just going to say there was a part in our last talk where you actually worked in Wheels Off into the conversation. And it was so awesome. Like, you relate. It was like, I meant to mention it last time. It was so good. You're like, here's everything going along. And it was like, Wheels Off. You know, it was funny. Anyway, go ahead.
That expression comes from, I have friends in Dallas that work on the radio, and they always say that as a way of describing something that is out of control.
Out of control.
Yeah.
I use the analogy in so many ways. I think in my book, I said I was like trying to like push the broken down wreck up the road, you know, the broken down wreck of a band.
That's where I wanted to start, by saying, congratulations on All I Ever Wanted. I think it's so beautiful. And I think the audiobook version, I'm sure reading it in print has its own benefits over the audio version. But I think hearing you tell your story in your own words is kind of a magical thing. So congratulations on that.
Oh, did you already do the intro?
Yeah, so I'm going to go back and record the intro, and I like how you interrupted me, and in the introduction, I'm going to address the fact that we had to redo this whole interview. So if it's all right.
Okay.
It's actually the perfect wheels off thing, right?
Yes, it is. The wheels came off on the wheels off. So I'm so glad that you did the audiobook because, first of all, I love that the soundtrack is incorporated into it. And I also love that the soundtrack producer, she like got the idea. She said, why don't you do some underscoring as well within the book? And that was a blast because I got to go back and like I found cassettes. Like when I write about my first band rehearsing, I actually found a cassette of the third band rehearsal of my first band.
Wow.
And it's so funny because I wrote in like the teeniest little letters, like on, you know, how thin the strip on a cassette is to write on. And I wrote down like every song, who was playing what on what song. But I managed to like take an excerpt of that first band rehearsal or third band rehearsal of my first band and underscore it when I'm reading about that. And other places in the book, I was able to kind of, you know, when I talk about playing Chuck Berry riff for the first, or Chuck Berry rhythm. And then she said, why don't you record you doing that? So that was, I mean, I was worried I wouldn't get an audiobook deal. And I had already decided I was going to do it myself if I didn't get one. Because they're really hard to get, you know, and it's all hinges on like, how well did so-and-so's book sell? You know, it can have nothing to do with you. But so they came in right at the last minute, right when I was about to do it by myself, which I would have done, but it would have sucked.
No, well, perhaps it wouldn't have been as good because they do it all the time. But yeah. God, it's so fun too. And one of the earliest moments when it really comes in the audiobook is you talk about the sunshine of your love, the Cream. And all of a sudden there's this chugging. And I'm like, did she get Cream? How did you get? Oh, no, you recorded your own version of something evocative of that sound.
Yeah, I didn't have time to make something. So I just looked through all the stuff I'd recorded and I thought, what sounds like bluesy rock that will approximate that? I mean, I would never presume to sound like Cream, but I just found something to kind of evoke that kind of era.
Boy, that moment in the book is such a great moment. You as a, God, I can't even think of what age you would have been, 10, standing outside the door, the closed door of some teenage, it was like a cousin or somebody's brother.
Yeah, it was my cousin. And it was really important to me to write a lot about music because I just feel like, one of the ways women get shorted in the music business is how passionate we are about music. You know, we're always looked at as like, you know, in other ways, but I just felt like it was a kind of a missing part of a lot of women's stories is their passion for music. And like everybody knows that, you know, what Buddy Holly and Muddy Waters were to the Stones and the Beatles, but you know, a lot of women, you don't seem to make that connection, like what like really set them on fire. And it was such a defining moment because I tried to really get it on the page, just like when all of a sudden, because music still does that. I mean, I listen to Miles Davis when I want to evoke a certain feeling, and I listen to reggae when I want to, you know, evoke that. I have the music and the songs that I go to. And hearing that Sunshine of Your Love was the first time that a new feeling happened. And it was really fun to write about. Really fun.
God, I love that. Well, and it's so cool that this book is out in the world and you've been promoting it for a while. And I wonder what creative project you're working on right now and how does it light you up?
Wow. Okay. So, well, doing the soundtrack to the book, which I thought was a genius move, and I still am slightly disappointed that the genius of it has gone a little unrecognized. But I mean, I just thought, why doesn't every musician do this? You know, I don't understand it. One thing we can do as if, you know, not every songwriter can write a book and not every book writer can write a song, but if you can do both, why not? And so, but anyway, it was so freeing because so many things became apparent that all the music that I create is generally, for the most part, for a band, you know, and to do something, and also a band that has a sound. Like all my bands have a sound. Like my band that I play with in Austin, the Blue Bonnets, we don't sound good doing like pop music. You know, we don't, it's just, we sound good doing just kind of rock and roll. And the Go-Go's don't sound that great doing any kind of rootsy. I mean, we do it. We can pull it off. But you know what I'm saying? You know, I don't want to place limitations. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that I had no limits. I could do like I even get like this swingy jazz thing on the last, like on Epilogue of Go-Go. I can't do it for 2 minutes, but for 60 seconds, I'm like swinging like crazy and like doing this crazy bass stuff. And then I'm like, wow, where do I go? I better stop. And like when I was doing the chapter that's all in the 70s, it's called Clubland. I really tried to evoke like a Curtis Mayfield sound and make it kind of funky and soulful. And for my dad's chapter about when he was proud of me for the first time, I could do kind of a country-ish song. So it was really fun. So to answer the question is, I'm so into this. It really interests me, this intersection of storytelling with music and writing. My dream, my next literary dream is to write a collection of short stories with an accompanying album. So it's a huge project because, first of all, I have to get confident with my skills as a fiction writer and a storyteller. And then I have to come up with an entire collection of them. I mean, we can imagine how hard it is to write 12 good songs for a record or something, to write like a collection of short stories. I don't even know how I'm going to do it. I mean, I've got about half a dozen, and then do the music with it. So that's what's got me excited.
So for the rock and roll, I mean, obviously the school that you went to for rock and roll was like Raoul's and the Roxy and whatever, the mean streets of rock and roll. But have you done, with regards to the prose writing, have you done much proper studying?
I've taken creative writing classes. I mean, the reason I was confident I could do a good book was that I had done extremely well in school. Even if it's not a writing class, I mean, I've been taking college classes on and off. I kind of go to school when I'm lost in life. This is my secret to life. Like if things seem really screwed up and like you're spinning your wheels, I take a class. I go to college because I like learning. I like the feeling of moving forward, of accomplishing something. And with music, a lot of times you pour your time and your effort and your creativity and your talent into something, and it doesn't always find an audience. And, you know, I have learned to just be, that's enough, that I'm proud. That's enough. Because I've done plenty of things that don't find an audience. But with school, you get something. You don't need an audience. All you need is to, like, for me, like, oh, I got an A in the class. Yay, me. So I have like I've got, you know, the highest GPA you can get, and I've excelled at school, and a lot of it's because of writing, you know, because a lot of college work is just writing. So I knew I could write. So I've done creative writing classes. I've done workshops and stuff. So I was pretty confident. But also when I first got on Facebook, I was never a big Facebook person, but every year, and I have one coming up, on my sober anniversary, I would write a very heartfelt, open post about getting sober. And it always resonated really strongly with people. And I would get a lot of response. And that gave me confidence that being vulnerable and open on a page connects in a way that I always like to connect musically. So it's just a new way of connecting.
How many years sober are you?
On January 21st, I'll be 32 years.
God, congratulations.
Thanks.
That's so cool. I'm at 5.
Oh my God. That's awesome. You're one of us. I didn't know that.
Yes.
One of us.
Exactly. I think that is so cool. God, so 32 years. That's great. And in these short stories, I can't wait to read them. I think that's so cool. I wonder, we talked a little bit about that moment listening outside your cousin's door to Sunshine of Your Love. And boy, you cover this so well in some of in the early chapters of your book. The moment that you realized that you were going to do this as a thing for your whole life. And can you go through that for us, the epiphany moment?
Yeah, I mean, what I love writing the memoir because I think everybody looks back on their life and it's just these fragments of meaningful things, things you just never forget, things that you've almost made up, but they, you know, that you've kind of pieced together. But writing a book, it becomes an order. It becomes a picture, all the fragments and things that I thought took 4 years to happen. I'm like, whoa, that was 3 months that all that happened in. So what I realized writing the book was that, man, when I first started playing guitar, I didn't even occur to me I could play in a band, even though I was 14 and I was this little rock and roller. I mean, that's what I was. All the bands I loved were rock and roll bands. I didn't like folk music. I didn't like anything that I saw females doing unless it was Janis Joplin or something. So everyone I liked was the Faces and the Who and Zeppelin and the Stones and T-Rex and Bowie. And it was all male rock and roll. That was it. So I start playing guitar and I don't connect the guitar to what I like more than anything. So what is that? It's like, it's not visible. It's just, you know, it's not visible in my world. And I've really enjoyed this time promoting my book because I've gotten to really pay a debt, a huge debt to Susie Quattro, who changed everything for me. My mom's English. We would go to England periodically. It had a huge, profound effect on my life, these little visits to England, because sometimes they happened when my life was shit, and it gave me a perspective, like there's more in this world. And that's what rock stars did too. They're like, okay, these are outlier people and they are succeeding. You know, I don't have to be that person from that family to succeed. So anyway, when I saw Susie Quattro bring a rock star, that was when the two dots connected. And one of the things I'm so intrigued by, I'm sorry, I just blabber on, and I know people that listen to this.
No, stop.
I know they want to hear you talk. I know
no,
they want
to. Don't.
Okay. Well, so one of the things that drives me crazy is that there were bands in the 60s. I mean, when I met, I always say it wrong. Is it Genya Raven or Genya? I never know whether it's a hard G or a soft G. Goldie and the Gingerbreads. When I met her the summer before last, she's showing me, she had a band in 1962, Goldie and the Gingerbreads. They were women playing instruments. And there was, you know, Susie's band, the Pleasure Seekers. And there was this band, the Debutantes, that were touring. And there were so many bands. And then Fanny was successful. But 1973 in Austin, Texas, I'd never heard of any of those bands, never heard of any of them. It wasn't until I saw Susie Quattro that it occurred to me that I could be in a band. So one thing that makes me really, like, puts me on a bummer as a woman musician is, I mean, the guys, they saw it everywhere and they were all like, yeah, I'm going to do that. I'm going to start a band. I just wonder how many bands we didn't get to have because of teenage girls in the 60s and 70s that didn't see that, you know? And that was such a crucial part of rock and roll development and cultural heavyweights in terms of music was the 60s and 70s. I mean, and I just wonder, I just feel like women would have been a lot more a part of it if there had been that, if there'd been YouTube or, you know, just more press or I don't know. It's just the way it is. There was no fanzines, you know, there was no, it's almost like because it wasn't successful, you didn't know about it.
It wasn't amplified.
Yeah, it wasn't amplified. So just imagine if I had seen Fanny, you know, when they had their hit, which was, I think, 1971. When
what
they
was had their Charity hit?
Ball, Charity Ball.
Okay.
It's an amazing song. If I'd seen that band, I probably would have had that in mind the minute I picked. I probably would have said, I'm going to do that. So anyway, that's just my little rant.
It was Susie Quattro. Boy, and I loved hearing like getting to, for you getting to meet and hang out with the Runaways when they came through?
Oh my God. I love that story. And every time I see Joan, I mean, she's probably, so she even said, yeah, you've told me. Because every time I see her, I tell her, I go, do you remember that time? And she's like, yeah, you've told me. Because there was something about that whole thing about being in their hotel, being in Joan's hotel room. So first time I felt safe enough to go, because to me, being misconstrued as a groupie was like the worst thing that could happen. Because I wanted that proximity. I wanted to hang around people in bands, but I didn't want them to think that I wanted to get laid, because I didn't. I just wanted to that proximity. And I'm not talking about musicians I knew, but like guys that would come through town or something. Like I remember hanging out with AC/DC and they assumed I was just trying to, you know, have sex. But with the Runaways, of course, now we know they could have thought the same thing. But at that time, I was like, I'm hanging out for the first time with a band in their hotel. And, you know, that story with Joan, like putting some beer, like putting some ice in her sink in the Holiday Inn sink, like going down the ice machine and then spinning the beer cans in the sink to get them cold. I mean, I was cracking up because, you know, fast forward a few years later and the Go-Go's are on tour and I'm like, this is how you do it, man. No, that's not what I'm saying, but that's how I'm acting. I'm just acting like, yeah, I learned this from Joan Jett. So pretty funny. And I just was so excited. And I love that story where I was like so excited to meet them. And then Lita was just like, yeah, so. And I've told Lita that story too. Funny.
Oh my God, that's so funny. Yeah, Joan Jett was my first, she was my gateway drug to everything. Like I heard her cover Rebel Rebel on the King Biscuit Flower Hour and then went and found David Bowie because of that. Like when I was
really
10 years old or something like that. I don't know, for some reason she clicked with me before everybody else, Bad Reputation. I finally
that's
got to meet.
That's so awesome. And it's so funny you would say that song, because I was just, today's the deadline. I have to turn in 5 songs for an interview I'm doing that I can talk about. And one of the ones I picked is Rebel Rebel.
How come you picked it?
Because there was some, I think I was 15 when it came out. And I think I had started playing guitar, but I hadn't really launched into anything. And there was something about the character of that song, even though I was kind of a wild kid and it wasn't like, oh, that represents something. There was just something about the storytelling and the whole thing. It just made me feel like, yeah, this is this world. This is these are these characters that I inhabit. And it was just this kind of finding yourself and finding your tribe. And not only Bowie, but the story he was telling about the character, the Rebel Rebel character, felt like my tribe.
That's so cool. I wonder to what extent Mick Ronson is underappreciated for his production contributions to that whole scene. He was such a big part of that sound, right?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I went down a Mick Ronson hole not too long ago. I think, is there a documentary? I think there's a documentary about him.
Heartbreaking.
It's not as good as you want it to be.
Yeah.
But it's enough to kind of send anybody down a hole. And that's what happened. Yeah.
I watched it on an airplane in the before times when people flew.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So you, since you were young, it's funny that you talk about how much you love school, because when you were like in high school, it seems like you were skipping most of the time and doing rock and roll stuff, right? Like you weren't super into school back then.
Well, I dropped out of high school in the middle, 3 months into ninth grade. I made it through high school. And it was with my mom's, you know, sanction. She found another school for me. She found a commune, because they were going to call Child Protective Services, because my mom and I, we thought we were working the system, because I wasn't interested. I had started caring about grades. So I was making straight A's, but I wasn't going. And they called me in to the office and said, you know, you've missed something like, you know, 2/3 of the semester. And I said, but my absences are excused and I'm making straight A's. So what's the problem? And they said, the problem is that there's something wrong in your household. And my mom freaked out. And she found a school. It was unaccredited. It was a hippie commune. And it was the first time I remembered really being happy, you know, when I look back. And that's where I learned guitar. And it would make an amazing documentary. One day, I know it sucks. You get to an age where you realize you might not have time to do all the things you want to do. But one day, it would be super cool to do a documentary on Greenbrier, because what a place that was.
It's interesting to hear the way you described it as being just anarchy, you know, lawless. But then you talk about how every kid you knew that came out of it went on to do something substantial, or like lawyers and business entrepreneurs or whatever.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And there was a movie that was out in the 70s. I think it was called there was a book called Summer Hill, and then Billy Jack, the movie. I think they kind of tread on this ground of the alternative or the free school, which basically the whole philosophy is that kids want to learn. They're curious. It's a natural state of growing up, is to wonder. And if you give them the freedom, they will find what they're good at. They will find what interests them. And that's what I've seen happen from all the kids in that school. You know, whereas the ones I was in high school with, you know, with the advent of Facebook, I've found some, oh, what happened to so-and-so? Oh, he killed himself in jail. You know, what happened to so-and-so? It's like big time Loserville. And I can't lie. I get like, cause these are the same people that tortured the hell out of me and lied about me and my mom and said her and spread vicious, horrible rumors. And, you know, generally made my life awful. So slight satisfaction. Not at the jail suicide, maybe, but, you know, in general.
So the Go-Go's doc that came out recently is pretty incredible in a lot of ways, just because I grew up loving the Go-Go's. I got the first record from the Columbia Record and Tapes Club for a penny, you know, get a dozen records for a penny. And just thought it was so cool. But there were so many things I didn't know, you know, talk about wheels off. It seems like those were a handful of years, you know, in your life when it just, it seemed kind of crazy. I can't put words in your mouth, but just from the outside, like, wow, what a freaking insane ride that must have been. And I wonder, like, as it went, I know that was before you were sober. I just wonder, like, surviving that, coming out of it, and then sort of dealing with the, I don't know, we've talked about this before, the internally generated obstacles. Like, how did you deal? What were the healthy ways you found to get past the trickier times in your life?
Well, humor is the number one thing. And, you know, one of these people I connected with on Facebook from when I was really young that wasn't an asshole, he said, he goes, "You were always so funny." He said, "You used to crack me up." And I was kind of surprised, because I really, when I became a musician and left normal school and all that, I really thought of that as a different life. And it was interesting to hear from someone. But so as soon as the Go-Go's, you know, I don't know. I felt like this. I mean, I think I'm funny anyway, but there was something about being in the Go-Go's where I just cranked that up as much as I could. And I was such the prankster of the band, and I was equally matched with Belinda. And so I got such joy out of making everyone laugh and being a goofball and being outrageous. And, you know, the things that were hard, or like when we were like, you could just be exhausted and frustrated and maybe a bunch of things have gone wrong, and just making everybody laugh and come together for a minute just felt really good. So I used humor a lot, and I used it to the point where I just felt like I was like on all the time. It was exhausting. And I also felt like it was like something I could control. Like if I could make everybody happy and laughing and keep it fun, that maybe I wouldn't lose this thing that was everything to me. So it was, looking back, it must have been exhausting because I felt this enormous, just that kind of illusion that we have control over something and that we can control whether somebody's having a good time and wants to do it. You know, that's immaturity.
Boy, that was something in the last few years in therapy that came up, because I think I'm a lot like you in that respect. And a therapist said to me, you know, you can't make someone else happy, right? And I realized that that's like been my whole life, is trying to make other people happy, and that's impossible.
Yeah, me too. And I mean, in my sobriety in my 30s, I realized how much I had been doing that for my mom. Like my relationship with my mom is just so like weird and convoluted. And it's now come to a place where I love my mom. You know, she drives me crazy, but I love my mom, but I resent her because I've taken care of her my entire adult life, you know, and that's just kind of my deal in life, is taking care of her. I'm not going to let her die on the street. But yeah, it's like, I think I was in therapy before someone said, like for years before the therapist said, you know, if your mom wanted her life to be different, you know, she's a grown up. She'd figure it out, you know.
Wow.
But I would do crazy, like I would go visit my mom, and like, it was like going to visit a college student, me being the mom. Like you need a tea kettle. You can't boil your water in a pan. Oh, your mattress is on the floor. We need to get you a bed frame. I mean, literally, I would do this stuff and then go back 4 months later and be pissed off because the tea kettle was, you know, not being used and the bed wasn't, you know. And it's just like, it was weird. Anyway, I don't know if I want to go to all that. So it's probably
dull. I know. Sorry, I brought it up.
No, it's just probably dull. That's probably not what people want to hear me talk about.
Well, I got to say, though, I did think that a lot of that stuff, your relationships with your mom and your dad, I thought that's some of my favorite stuff and all I ever wanted. And I think that your vulnerability in going to those places is so admirable. It's so brave.
Yeah, it's such a big part of the story. And I, you know, I felt like I really wanted to write a literary memoir. I have read a lot of memoirs, and my least favorite of them are the music ones. I like literary memoirs by Mary Carr, who's written a series, The Liars Club and Cherry, and different slices of her life. Or, you know, Augustine Burroughs, Running with Scissors is a favorite. And Cheryl Strayed, Wild. And all my favorite memoirs are Tara Westover. And some of the musician ones I liked, you know, go back to like Art Blakey, you know, different weird random ones. But I really wanted mine to be a literary memoir. And of course, the Go-Go's was going to be a part of it, but because that's part of that story and that era that I wrote about. But it was super important to me that I get to write the story about the humanity and the context of why this band was so important, and the thing of just losing yourself and your identity. And I mean, so many people have told me that they thought that reading about what it would be like to be in a band, making it, would be most interesting. And they said, you did a great job with that, but the parts that really sat with me, the parts that made me cry, the parts that made me see myself, were what happened to you before the band and what happened to you or me after the band.
Yeah. Well, I would 100% agree with that. The stories from your childhood had me riveted. And yeah, I for sure shed a few tears. Well, you and I'm glad. I know you've lived through so much before and after those, whatever that half decade of your life that's sort of the most celebrated. You've done so much work before and after that. It's really cool. I mean, the bands that you were in, even in the, you know, I love you going to see the Sex Pistols, and then, you know, just we're going to go to LA. I mean, the level of bravery that you've exhibited throughout your life, I think is such the hallmark of a true artist. I think it's such a great takeaway from your story.
Yeah, I think it's weird. I mean, like, it never occurred to me I wasn't going to make it. Never entered my mind. And I don't know what that is. You know, I'm still like that to a degree. I always shoot for the top. You know, I don't like it when I hear anyone say, oh, this can't happen. I always say, don't say that. You know, I believe language and words are really powerful. I believe thoughts are powerful. And, you know, I mean, even when I wrote my book, in my mind, there was no reason it couldn't be a New York Times top 10 bestseller. In my mind, it didn't happen. But in my mind, why not? Why not? You know, and yet at the same time, I'm fine with when it doesn't happen. It's not like I'm a failure, you know. So, but it didn't occur to me that I wouldn't make it. And then what I loved writing about in the book was like, it's such a thing when you're, I don't know if it's being young or if it was just, maybe it's just part of LA, but all these little things, the little carrot on the stick that just makes you think, you know, and it's still like that, I think, to a degree. I remember when the Go-Go's broke up and I floundered, this would be probably in the next memoir, but I floundered and I tried all this band and that band and what do? Do I play guitar again? Do I play bass? Nobody knows that I play guitar. I better just play bass. Well, I want to play, you know, oh, I'll do this band. Do I sing? Well, I probably am not good enough to sing. I'm just flopping around. And finally, I put this band together. And it's so really fun. It's called the Blue Bonnets. It's the first version of the Blue Bonnets. And we go play a gig, our first gig. And we get asked from that gig, would you guys be interested in playing a wedding? And I'm like, well, how much, you know? And I negotiate for how much. And we show up at this wedding gig. And it's freaking Angelica Houston's wedding. And we're playing our second gig and dancing in front of us is like Warren Beatty and Annette Bening and Mick Jagger. And we're playing like Slim Harpo songs and Mick Jagger's like watching. And it was like one of the most incredible gigs of my life. And I'm like, this could only happen in LA where you just happen to do this little pub and it just happens to be someone there that's the brother of her that's booking a wedding band. And we became the wedding band to the stars for a while. That's what we became. Because from that, there was people there that hired us for other weddings. It was crazy. But that's LA. Like, that doesn't happen anywhere else. And like writing in, like, you know, I'm just rehearsing with the Textones, my first band. And we had decided to do this cover of Second That Emotion. And we're playing the freaking song. And Smokey Robinson walks in and sings it with us. Mm. I mean, that's like magic. So, and I've been in LA like 9 months when that happened. So to me, all these things are just like, you're doing the right thing and you're going to make it. And this place is freaking like Disneyland or whatever. You know, it's like, this is like, anything can happen here. I don't know if it's still like that, or maybe it's just being young. I don't know.
I mean, see, I moved out of there in 2003, and it still felt like that. And I do miss it sometimes. I miss that feeling of, well, like you say, it's just, you know, at any given moment, someone can walk in and say, oh, I want you to be in my movie or whatever. Yeah. But I also, I like living in a real place. I mean, that sounds really shitty and judgmental, but I know, like, I love Austin where you live, and I'm in the Hudson Valley in New York, which is kind of a college town, Hippieville, just north of Manhattan. I like not having to worry about, is Smokey Robinson gonna walk in right now?
Well, I would still, you know, love that. But I think the thing is that you're just not, like, I think you just get to a point in life where instead of you're looking so much, you're learning to be content with what you have. That's what I feel like the 60, I'm at that point of my age where I'm not looking for things so much. And I'm looking more to how to be content with what I have. Like, you know, this might be it. And that's cool, you know. But at the same time, I'm still, you know, like I said, I write a book and dream that it's going to be, you know, bestseller. So I'm still like wanting things, but a large part of my comfort in the world is learning to be happy with what I have. So maybe that's part of it. Whereas when in LA, those years, I mean, when I left LA to come back to Austin, I really felt like I was cashing in my chips. I really felt like it. I felt like I moved here. I had an amazing career. I found a band that fulfilled my dream. I met a great guy. I had a baby. What the fuck else can happen here? You know? Yeah. And I came back to Austin, you know? And it felt like I was cashing my chips in.
Well, so that brings us to, that's a perfect segue to the self-advice proposal, which is if you were to run into a 21-year-old Kathy Valentine, but living in today's world, what advice do you think you might give yourself?
I've thought about this, and I'm enjoying so much just being Kathy Valentine right now. Between the book and the pandemic, it's like I've always put my effort into the group, you know, the thing around me, the big puffy protection. It's nobody's looking right at me. I can go write a song. Nobody's going to hear my bad lines. Nobody's going to hear my off key singing. I'm never going to be judged because I'm in the background doing what I do best. And then the whole finished product goes out. And all I have to do is be cool on stage and hold up my end. And it's been really safe. And writing a book is like as unsafe as it gets. You know, it's like I've exposed myself to, I mean, I try not to do it, but I've read some like vicious things written about me, about my book. And the last one was so vicious that I just thought I'm not going to do that anymore. But I opened myself up to stuff by putting it out there. But that's not the point. The point is that between the book and the pandemic, where normally I would just go back into doing stuff for my band, but I can't do that. So I've been doing Kathy Valentine. I've been doing interviews. And the more things I do, the more I get asked to do. Like in the past, if all these Austin musicians were getting together to do something, I wouldn't get asked. And I'd be like, well, nobody asked me to do nothing. And I'd be like, oh, well, maybe it's because you just present yourself as part of a band and they can't invite a whole band. And so the more I do, the more I get asked. And I've been doing recordings and I've been making videos and really enjoying just being me. And so, sorry, I get so long-winded. So what I would do, that's one thing I regret, is that I would tell myself, be in a band, give it your all, but don't forget about you too. Like be me too. Like I mean, you do that. Like you do that. You have your band, but you do you. And, you know, Rod Stewart had the Faces at the same time he was being Rod Stewart. And it's just like, I just didn't have the confidence, really. I didn't have the confidence. I felt it was a number of things. I wanted that feeling of belonging. I wanted to feel like I was in a family, but I think I was also scared that maybe I wasn't good enough. Maybe I wasn't, you know, didn't have what it takes or whatever. And maybe I did, maybe I didn't, who knows. But there was no reason not to be me more. And now I'm being me and I really like it. And I kind of wish I'd done it more.
So maybe it's like, let yourself know that you've got more going on than you're giving yourself credit for. Don't be afraid to step out.
Yeah, just kind of don't let the whole define the part. Like I'm a part of something, but don't make my being a part of it be all I am.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Like I feel like I just let myself get defined too much as just being a part of something and didn't think that my singular part had any value. And now I'm feeling like it has lots of value.
Like it would survive the dissolution of the thing.
I think there was just potential that didn't get realized that, you know, it's gone.
Well, I don't know. You're making up for lost time. You're doing a lot of great stuff right now, which is so cool.
Yeah. Thank goodness I figured it out now and not like when I was 80. All right, everybody. I'm going to sing this song now.
Oh, man. Well, I feel like I could talk to you for days, and I really appreciate you giving me the time and the Wheels Off listeners, and I appreciate the book. I feel like it's just such a gift to be able to hear this wisdom and look inside of your mind. It's very fascinating. Thank you so much for being on Wheels Off, Kathy.
Thank you. I really liked it.
All right. Thank you so much for listening to Wheels Off. Please be sure to rate and review the show on iTunes. That helps us appear higher in the search results and lets other folks know that it's a cool podcast to listen to. Also, as the kids say, don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or anywhere else that you listen to shows like this so that you never miss an episode. This has been Wheels Off, and I'm Rhett Miller, encouraging you to create every day. Thanks, y'all.
Hi, this is Henry Kay, host of the number one music history podcast, Rootsland. Come with me on a journey to Kingston, Jamaica, where we explore the world of reggae music and the untold stories of some of the genre's greatest legends. From the ghettos and tenement yards where the music was born, to the island's iconic recording studios. We are so excited to team up with Osiris Media, the leading storyteller in music, because as you'll hear, sometimes the story is the best song.